This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Next, we'll continue our discussion with Naomi Klein about globalization, debt, Argentina, economic alternatives, and the resilience of people. Naomi Klein claims that her passion for the connections between social justice and economics were inherited from her family. Her grandparents were socialist union organizers. Her grandfather, a Donald Duck animator, was one of the ringleaders of the first animator strike against Walt Disney. He was subsequently blacklisted and was never able to work as an animator again. Klein's parents were peace activists, working against the Vietnam War. Politics and the relations between people were always important. In the documentary, The Take, people decided to take to the streets, take back their jobs, take out their leaders, and take a chance. Eleanor Ostrinsky continues her discussion with Naomi Klein.
Part of the strength of the film that you made, The Take, is actually its title. Tell us how you came up with that.
The film is about people responding to this crisis in their lives, the crisis of unemployment, the crisis of capital flight, by just taking what they need and insisting that they have a right to work and they have a right to dignity, that they have a right to survival. Unemployment was in the 30% range. Half the country was living in abject poverty. Bosses said, we're closing down the plant. And they just said, well, we're not leaving. And they occupied their factories and they kept them running. More than that, they started to make legal arguments that they actually were the owners of the factory. And they made these arguments mostly to the state, because at this point, the factories were usually in bankruptcy, which meant that the state took control over the assets. But workers are always the last to get paid in these bankruptcy proceedings. And what happens is that you have a bankruptcy trustee put in charge of the factory, and they sell off the assets, and then they pay back the people who are first on the list, and they make their way down, and usually workers don't get paid anything. The workers in Argentina have been making a legal argument in the courts to change the bankruptcy law so that they get paid first, and that they get paid not with money, but with the machines, so that they can keep these assets productive and that they can then in turn pay the suppliers and the other creditors. The other legal argument that they've been making is that in Argentina, like in so many parts of the world, including the United States, there is a tremendous amount of corporate welfare that is handed out. Corporations are enticed to set up with all kinds of incentives, tax breaks. Often a factory would be given free land. They would be given free utilities. They would build a road for them. I mean, they would do all kinds of things. So what the lawyers in this movement have been doing is tallying up how much public money has gone into these factories and finding that in most cases, more public money has gone directly into these factories than private money. So they're saying, well, whose factory is this? Why should we accept that we're going to lose this factory that we have built as a community? And they're keeping them running and they're transforming them into workers' cooperatives. So when workers in Argentina do a takeover, they call it La Toma, the take. So that's why the film's called The Take.
Yeah, well, it's also the take home pay.
We see it as kind of embodying a spirit of direct action, which we see not just in Argentina's occupied factory movement, but in a lot of the really vibrant social movements where people are resisting policies of deprivation and austerity by taking what is their human right, whether it's squatting a building because they need it for housing or squatting land in Brazil and turning it into productive agricultural land or reconnecting water pipes and electricity connections in South African townships like the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee does. And there is a new spirit of activism, and these movements are connecting to one another through forums like the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre and seeing themselves in each other's struggles. What's most interesting to me about the occupied factory movement is that they are making sure that they don't repeat the mistakes of former Soviet states where you replace a private boss with basically a state bureaucrat who are the elite, even if they're using the rhetoric of socialism. So they are insistently democratic and making all of their decisions in assemblies. And when people do try to come in and take them over, often the democracy in the factory keeps it in check. I think that what makes them different, because it's not a new idea that workers should seize the means of production, is their deep, deep, deep faith in democracy and insistence on it.
Well, also, democracy is defined a little bit differently given our times, but it is the collective action. It's the idea that the collective will make decisions and that everybody will discuss it and then come to a conclusion that will be beneficial for all.
There's definitely that. But I think the other thing that's really different is the idea that democracy is not something that you just do every few years. It's that democracy is really a way of life and a way to run your life. You know, in the United States, it's interesting that in the place where we spend the vast majority of our time, which is the workplace, not only is there no democracy, but even the most basic human rights are denied. The right to privacy, I mean, you could be under surveillance all the time. You have to undergo drug testing. So this idea that work is exempt, not just from democracy, but civil liberties completely. So I think that this is a really interesting challenge to that, where we were there during an election campaign, a presidential election campaign, where actually Carlos Menem tried to stage a comeback and Nestor Kirchner ended up winning. We used that presidential election campaign as the frame for our film to show that's one form of democracy, the democracy of spectatorship. It's not that it's irrelevant, because people didn't want Menem to win, but there was definitely a sense of that the real change was going to happen elsewhere. It was going to happen through alternatives that were about how you work and how you live and how you produce. And so we ended up with a documentary film with a happy ending, which nobody can believe, really, because most documentary films don't have happy endings. But, you know, Menem was defeated, and the group of workers we followed did manage to get their factory running.
Another part of the film is that the people who took the factories were not what people envision, you know, as these radical revolutionaries. There were people who were middle class, who made a decent living, and all of a sudden couldn't even put some bread on the table to feed their children. And so you follow this particular family. Can you tell a little bit of the story?
The people in our film, they become leaders because their circumstances demand it, but they're very ambivalent about it. There's no sort of firebrand person who, you know, steps to the fore. And I think that's really interesting, because it shows that you don't actually need it. And Freddie, who, you know, who was the head of the cooperative during the takeover, is now, it's rotated and it's somebody else. And he's got just gone back to working in the factory and supporting his family. But, you know, his family is this lovely, he's got these two gorgeous girls, and his wife is absolutely charming. Everybody falls in love with her, because she talks about how long it's been. It took 3 years for them to do this, and she keeps praying to her Virgin Mary in the back room, but she thinks that her Virgin has gone deaf because she's so sick and tired of hearing her complain. And they talk about how they can't buy their kids Happy Meals anymore. And, you know, they were a middle-class family that fell out of the middle class, and that was the case for all the men in that factory. I mean, these were auto workers who were making a good wage, and, you know, they weren't rich, but they were able to, you know, take vacations and buy a car and buy a house. And now they were facing that dilemma of whether or not they could pay their bills or feed their kids. But there were other people in the factory who had fallen even further and were working as scavengers to survive, or were working as what are called cartoneros. They collect the cardboard in the garbage and they sell it. And, you know, we followed them through this process, and they opened up their lives and their houses to us. And there was, you know, there's a tremendous difficulty in doing that for the people in our film, because these are very macho men who are deeply ashamed that they can't provide for their families, because all of their identity was tied up in being providers, and then they lost that. So, you know, taking their factory back and getting their jobs back is really, you know, you see them transformed, really, from being broken men to having some dignity. And it's quite joyful. But there's this moment in the film where they get the law passed, which gives them the legal recognition. Their law of expropriation is passed. And it's the first time they've won anything. And it was an incredible moment, because I guess I was expecting that they would be happy. And what happened is that they all fell apart. And they weren't tears of joy. It was that they had been holding it together for 2 years, struggling, working as scavengers, feeling like total failures, like they had betrayed their families and themselves, some of them turning to alcohol and drugs. And this victory happened, and it gave them permission to fall apart. And we just found ourselves in this room of just grown men weeping. And there was a celebration later, but that was their first reaction. And that was when I realized how deeply they had lost.
So what do you take from this experience that you had in Argentina and from this film?
I think that there's a few things to take. On the macro level, what I take is that we need to be more ambitious in how we think about who owes what to whom. Because we've allowed institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the banks to define who is owed money. And debt is one of the greatest forms of social control in the world. And there are other debts. And what I found really exciting and what I think really is transferable, not just the tactic of taking over a factory that's being shut down, but these legal arguments that are being made about who actually owns these machines when they've been so heavily subsidized with public money. You know, I do a fair bit of work in Canada with First Nations groups, and they're making similar arguments about what they are owed in terms of land. And in the United States, you have the African American community making similar arguments about reparations for slavery, which is challenging the whole idea of who are the freeloaders and who has actually broken a deal. And I think that that is the most revolutionary idea that I take from this experiment, which is just that I believe that the disenfranchised of the world are not the debtors, but the creditors. And that if we boldly make these arguments, the future we want may already be paid for. On a smaller level, what I hope people take from the film, just the ability to start the discussion a little further along, because I think it's a bad habit that we have on the left that we just are so good at criticizing. And I certainly include myself in this, particularly with Bush in power. There's a hell of a lot to critique, and we need to do it. But we also all know that we need to talk and start building the alternatives that we want. But that always kind of gets squeezed to the end. My friend Rahul Maharajan, who writes about U.S. empire, we were talking about the phrase another world is possible at an event, and he was saying that we need to talk about the other world, but we also need to talk about possible, because sometimes we think we can leap over the possible part and just get to utopia on the other end, you know? Well, how do we get there from here? And so I don't feel like this film is a manifesto for a new world. I don't know how to do that, and I don't know that that's what's needed. But what's nice about it is that it starts with the possible, and then we can take it from there.
What would you do if your money disappeared? Email us. Go to www.maryknoll.org/voices. Just choose the Contact Us button. Or you can call us at 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 1-877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Naomi Klein is just one of the voices of our world. This week's show was produced by Eleanor Ostrinsky, and I'm your host, Eileen Bott. You heard music today by Irene Ferreira. To suggest a topic or for more information on today's guests, just go to our program's website, www.maryknoll.org/voices. To get Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, please call 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. If you missed a portion of this program, you can catch us on our website, www.maryknoll.org/voices. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.